welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, my own Mr. Watson, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Hey, I wanted to take just a quick second here at the start of the show to thank so many of the listeners. You know, we had an unexpected death in the family with my wife. Her father passed away the other day, and it was a certainly unexpected. Although he has not been in the best of health over the last few years, he seemed to be doing pretty well. The only upside to this is that he had called her just before he passed away, and they had a lovely conversation on the phone, and he went out to walk the dog and suffered a massive heart attack. And luckily was found almost immediately upon collapsing by a neighbor who was also out walking the dog. By the time the ambulance arrived 2 minutes later, he had already expired and was gone. So it was a surprise, but my wife thankfully got to be the last voice he could hear here on earth, and they shared a lovely conversation and laughs and everything. So it's tough, of course. She's lost both parents in a span of 3 years. So all the outpouring of love and affection and attention from the listeners and all the great comments, thank you so much for that. And I appreciate you understanding us running a couple of our special episodes this past weekend on Darkness Radio. It came as a surprise, and Tim and I just didn't have time to adjust. So Tim was kind enough to go through the dark archives and found a couple of the episodes we'd always wanted to go back to replay. And we hope you guys enjoyed those episodes as well. We'll be back this weekend with all new episodes of Darkness Radio. Next weekend, or next Tuesday, Mark Anthony will be back with more Killer Cuts. We're going to talk about I think four different serial killers and some other strange crimes. We'll be talking about that next Tuesday on the show. But today, Stephen Epstein joins us. And Stephen has a brand new book that just came out. He is a litigation partner in Raleigh, North Carolina, has been practicing law for 30 years and has tried many jury and non-jury trials in courtrooms throughout North Carolina and has argued numerous appeals. Since 2015, Mr. Epstein's legal practice has focused primarily on family law. His first book, Murder on Birchleaf Drive, The True Story of Michelle Young Murder Case, reached number one on Amazon's bestseller list in the true crime genre. His second book, which is what he's here to talk with us about right now, Evil at Lake Seminole, The Shocking True Story Surrounding the Disappearance of Mike Williams, was just released on June of 2020. Mr. Epstein lives in Raleigh with his wife and children, who one by one are leaving the nest. And I know that feeling all too well, Stephen. Thank you and join us. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Let's get started. Again, this being your second book and working in the field of law, I know this gives you an interesting perspective when looking into these cases, but what about these two cases made you decide to, you know, dive deep and write a book about them?
Probably the victim in each, very compelling life story for the victim in each, the family's quest for justice in each. In Murder on Birchleaf Drive, it was the mother and the sister of the victim. In this one, Evil Lake Seminole, it was the mother of the victim. Both interesting trials, actually two trials in the first case, one trial in this one, and just seeing how the law interacts with you know, the killing of somebody and trying to bring somebody responsible to justice is always an interesting story. But this one had so many, you know, amazing dynamics to it, including the thought for years by many that the victim simply drowned in a bad hunting accident and was eaten by alligators. And so if that's not fascinating enough to begin with, I don't know what is.
Wow, what a crazy, crazy tale. Well, introduce us to Mike Williams. Who was Mike Williams, and what was his life like?
Okay, Mike Williams grew up with one brother, who was his older brother, Nick, the son of Cheryl and JJ. Cheryl was a well-educated woman for her time. She graduated from Florida State. Her husband, JJ, was a bus driver for Greyhound. They grew up of very modest means in the Tallahassee area, just outside the city limits. And they actually lived in a mobile home. on a 2-acre tract of land, Cheryl thinking that it was much more important for her kids to have lots of room and space to play than anything real fancy in a home. And that's how they grew up, and not surprisingly, Mike became an outdoorsman from a very early age, starting as a kid hunting with bows and arrows, and by the time we pick up with the story, he's going duck hunting fairly regularly, and on the day in question, which was December 16, 2000, was duck hunting at Lake Seminole. Now, what did he do for a living? Mike, after graduating from Florida State, became a real estate appraiser. He worked for a company named Ketchum Appraisal. The proprietor there, Clay Ketchum, became like a dad to him, and he was extremely successful as a real estate appraiser. In fact, back in 2000, he was making upwards of $200,000 a year. But he was also a devoted family man. So in high school at the North Florida Christian School, a small private school that Cheryl and JJ scraped their nickels together to be able to afford, he met Denise Merrill in the ninth grade. Denise became his girlfriend pretty quickly, and ultimately he married Denise. So he married his high school sweetheart, and the events in question pick up on the eve of their sixth wedding anniversary. They also had a child, Ansley, and Ansley was 19 months old at the time Mike went missing from Lake Seminole. And Ansley, by all accounts, was his pride and his joy. And the book includes many pictures of Ansley and Mike and Ansley together. He would take her into the office. He worked 16-hour days, and he would take her into the office at night sometimes, do all of his paperwork, rocking her car seat with the ball of his foot while he did his paperwork. He would come home at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, then get up at 5 o'clock the next morning and begin the whole thing all over again. So he was extremely devoted to both his wife and his child. He was devoted to his mother and his brother. He worked really hard because he didn't want his own child or children to grow up as poor as he did when he was growing up. He wanted to provide. And by the time he died, he was living in a very nice home in an upscale neighborhood in Tallahassee, quite different from the circumstances in which he grew up.
Now, looking at this man's life overall, I mean, was he a good guy? Did he have quite a few friends? Was he a problem maker? What can you tell us regarding his personality?
He was as salt of the earth as you could possibly imagine. It was, I couldn't include all of the quotes from friends that had great things to say about him because there were so many. I'll just give you one example. Mike lived across the street from a public school girl named Denise Pate. And Denise Pate actually, ironically, became his first girlfriend, his first Denise. They were in middle school at the time. And Mike's mom didn't really approve of him dating a public school girl. She preferred for him to hang out with private school kids that he was going to school with. And ultimately, that put a strain on their relationship. So Denise Pate kind of sensed that and said, Mike, why don't we just be friends? And after then, they were just friends. And one day, Mike went over her home just as friends and learned that she had broken up with her new boyfriend, and she was in tears and very distraught. And the next day, Denise Pate went to school and was called out of her classroom to come to the principal's office, and she thought she had done something wrong, and instead, there was a dozen roses in a vase in the principal's office with a little card in there that Mike had written out with the lyrics to an Oak Ridge Boys song that they had liked when they were dating, and he was trying to console her for what she had just been through. And she remembers that vividly to this day, and that is emblematic of the type of guy that Mike Williams was, both as a younger guy and as he was an adult and a father and a husband. No one would have anything bad to say about him. He was that good a guy.
And in his business dealings, you know, was he the kind of guy that everybody looked up to and liked working with, or was he creating any enemies that way?
No, quite the opposite. Because he was following kind of in the footsteps of Clay Ketchum, Clay had introduced him to lots of people. Mike had political aspirations down the road, and he was an active member of the Kiwanis Club in the area. And again, he also organized hunts. He was a hunter, but sometimes he organized hunts on farms that would be leased for purposes of hunting. And he would do that for just acquaintances and friends. And they would gather 20, 30, 40 people for the hunt, and Mike would be the host. And he would make sure everybody had what they needed for the day, that if there were beverages that were needed, he would make sure they were there. He was a pleaser. No one could doubt that. And it got to the point in his relationship with his own wife that he was such a pleaser that she would, after Angela was born, she would need gas in her car. She would drive her car to a nearby gas station from where Mike worked. She would call him up and say, "Mike, I'm here at the gas station." He would leave his office, run down the stairs from the second floor office he had, run out the back door, get into his car, drive over to the gas station, park behind her, get out of his car, grab the pump, and pump her gas for her. That's the kind of guy Mike was.
Wow. So just an overall good guy. When we get to his disappearance here, it's not like there would have been anybody that you would even think would have any interest in hurting him at that point, correct?
Certainly not that he knew of.
All right. Well, let's walk us through that last fateful day of his. What was it like for him that day?
He was going to go duck hunting, and I think I should probably take you back to a couple evenings before.
Please.
When Cheryl Williams and Nick Williams visited Mike's upscale neighborhood, they had a tradition on Thursday evenings. They would get together and watch Friends. And so this was December 14th, 2000. It was Christmas time. There are Christmas decorations and lights up throughout the neighborhood. And Cheryl and Nick arrive. They park their vehicle. They come inside. Ansley is there. She waddles up to Cheryl. She grabs her. They have a good little reunion. And Mike isn't there. Mike is out getting pizza. Denise welcomes them in. They sit down. Mike eventually arrives with the pizza. And they're having family conversation as they're waiting for Friends to air. And there's a revelation that occurs during their get-together that night, which is Denise tells Cheryl and Nick that Mike and she have been talking and they're planning to have another child, which was the first time that had been mentioned to Cheryl or to Nick, that Ansley was potentially going to have a little brother or little sister. They weren't pregnant yet, but they were going to start trying real soon, Denise said. And then they started talking about their plans for the upcoming weekend. It was their sixth wedding anniversary, and they both said, "We're going to the Gibson Inn," which is a historic hotel on the Gulf of Mexico, on Apalachicola Bay, which is just south of Tallahassee. And they're going to go there, and they're going to spend the evening together and have a romantic getaway to celebrate their sixth wedding anniversary. And they also let Cheryl and Nick know that earlier that day, Mike is going to go hunting at Lake Seminole. He's going to go duck hunting, and he's going to be going duck hunting with his best friend, Brian Winchester, who he has also known since the ninth grade. Both Brian and Denise were at a different school while Mike was going to North Florida Christian School in elementary and middle school, and they both transferred into North Florida when they were in ninth grade. And Mike, just like he became girlfriend and boyfriend with Denise, he became best friends pretty quickly with Brian Winchester. And so it was clear to everyone that that morning would be a duck hunt at Lake Seminole with Mike and Brian. They would leave that morning, Mike would come back, and then he and Denise would head down to Apalachicola Bay to celebrate their sixth wedding anniversary. That was how the day was supposed to go, but of course, that's not how it went.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, just a picturesque kind of everyday, kind of a, you know, happy thing, and people getting together and good news and just all positive.
In fact, earlier that same day, Mike, Denise, and Ansley had their Christmas portrait taken by Denise's sister. Her older sister, Deanna, took her picture. It's actually in the book. And it looks like a picture straight out of Better Homes and Garden, you know, their Christmas edition, showing American families being happy around Christmas time. It's in front of the Christmas tree, smiling faces, bright smile on Denise's face, bright smile on Ansley's face. And that was the last picture ever taken of Mike Williams.
Oh. Well, we know how the day was supposed to unfold. What happens factually that we know unfolds, how do I want to put this? What's the story that unfolds that the world thinks of at that time, and then let's get to what the truth really was.
Okay, so Mike definitely went somewhere that morning because the alarm system at the Sonatrol alarm system at Ketchum Appraisal was alerted at about 4 o'clock that morning. And that makes sense because Mike stored his shotguns once Angeli was born there because he didn't want anything around with a 19-month-old around. So that makes perfect sense that he would have gone there that morning to get his shotgun and go hunting. And so that's the last physical evidence we have before any investigation, this, that he probably got his shotgun that morning. The next thing that happens is phone calls. Denise starts making phone calls to people, including her father, Warren Merrill, saying, Mike hasn't gotten back. I'm worried. I'm concerned. Supposedly, Mike was supposed to get back at about noon. Remember, they were heading out to the Gibson Inn. It's about two and a half hours away from their home in Tallahassee. And so at some point, he's supposed to get back home, change his clothes, pack up, and head down for their romantic getaway. But it gets to be 12, 1230, 1 o'clock, no Mike, and Denise starts calling around people, telling them she's very concerned. Concerned enough that her dad, Warren Merrill, heads up to Lake Seminole along with a friend of Mike's who was kind of like a protege to him. He was a younger guy who was at Florida State as a student who was working at Ketchum Appraisal. His name was Damon Jasper, and Damon and Mike had been to Lake Seminole duck hunting just the weekend before. So Warren and Damon head up. It's an hour ride northwest between from Tallahassee to Sneeds, Florida, which is the area of Lake Seminole. Lake Seminole is a very big lake, but the area that Mike typically went to was just north of Sneeds, which is on the Florida side of the lake. The lake also spills into Georgia. And so they drive up there, and they start looking around trying to find Mike's truck. He drove a Ford Bronco. And after being there for a while, they eventually spot Mike's truck. It has a boat trailer on the back, no boat, and no sign of Mike. The Fish and Wildlife officers, the Florida Wildlife Commission, get involved in trying to investigate what happened. Warren meets with them. Damon meets with them, tells them what he did the prior weekend, and they're convinced that, you know, Mike must be on the lake somewhere, out of gas, unable to get back, and they just need to find him. The problem is that there was a torrential rainstorm that was moving in very quickly, and before they could really begin much of an investigation, that rainstorm made any further investigation that afternoon impossible. In fact, three tornadoes respawned in the immediate vicinity of where they were looking. The area of the lake, I should say, that Mike's truck was found is something that locals called Stump Field, and that is actually on the front cover of the book. I took that picture from the vantage point of where Mike would have put his boat in order to begin duck hunting that morning. And you can see in the picture on the book, there are trees actually sticking out of the water. And not only are there trees sticking out of the water, there are also tree stumps that lurk just below the surface. And the theory was that Mike, who, by the way, Denise told everybody went hunting alone. She did not say he was going with Brian. In fact, she later said that Mike had said Brian called just before Mike left that morning to cancel, and that the last conversation that she had with Mike was him telling her he was going alone. Which is somewhat of a red herring. But in any event, Stump Field has so many of these underwater stumps that lurk below the surface that the FWC officers quickly theorized that Mike's boat likely hit one of those underwater stumps. It jostled him. He fell over and then drowned. Why would he have drowned if he fell over? Well, the theory was that Mike would have been wearing his waders at the time he fell over. And the theory is that if you fall over in a boat wearing waders and there's any water, the water is going to quickly fill those waders because it's not, waders are like a jumpsuit for a man that the bottom of the waders are rubber and you put your feet into rubber boots, but there's enough of a gap that water can get in there. And so water would have filled in to the point that it would have tugged him under the water and he drowned. And that was the theory probably from the first day. And once the storm blew over, the investigators were home for the evening, but the person who was there was Brian Winchester. He had learned what was going on at the lake. He and his father, Marcus Winchester, borrowed a boat, and they went out there on their own, and they were on the water at like 1 o'clock the next morning, December 17th, looking with headlights on their heads, and they found Mike's boat. So now they had Mike's truck that was at a nearby landing, and they had his boat against some tall reeds on the shoreline, and no Mike. So that's adding further support for this theory that Mike had been jostled, he fell in, he drowned. And it wasn't long thereafter that when his body didn't surface, despite an intense investigation involving dozens of officers from multiple different agencies, dozens of volunteers, despite that intense search and not finding him, that's how the theory developed that there were alligators in the area and alligators must have dismembered and eaten him.
And I mean, this is all, should we say, is this all too common situation for hunters and fisher people in that area? So that's why they would immediately kind of fall into this belief system of what might have taken place?
Well, it was true that some of the volunteers and officers who were searching in their boats had the same thing happen to them, where they hit a stump and were knocked out of their boats. And I'll tell you, as I was on Lake Seminole, the same day I took the picture that's on the front cover of the book, doing my research for this story, I was in a boat driven by an former FWC officer. We hit one of those underwater stumps, and I lurched violently forward, and I was about to go out of the boat when he grabbed me with his strong left hand, the back of my life jacket, and kept me from going over. So it wasn't, even today, it wouldn't be hard to believe that something like that could happen. The problem with the theory is that 80 people had drowned in Lake Seminole over the course of the 20 or 30 years before this incident. Every single one had been found. A body had been found every single time. Now, that doesn't mean that in this particular location of Lake Seminole, Stump Field, you had a bunch of people that drowned. But throughout Lake Seminole's entire history, it had never been the case that someone had drowned and their body hadn't been recovered until Mike Williams. And that was a red herring.
All right. Now, we have a friend of ours out of Texas who finds, you know, one of his jobs is finding the bodies in lakes. And it seems like, you know, it's real easy for people to go missing and bodies to, you know, get torn up and fall down there. And sometimes if the water's murky, it's hard to find these bodies. Was the water clear? Was there any indication, any, you know, pieces of the waders or fabric or anything that showed up that made them think that maybe there was gator involvement?
No, nothing whatsoever. The water wasn't clear. It was filled with this weed-like plant called hydrilla. And the hydrilla had these long tentacles, and they literally blanketed the entire area so that it was very difficult to see anything. So instead of trying to visually see whether there was a body in the area, all the volunteers and officers were given PVC pipes or poles, and they would probe the lake bed with these long pipes trying to feel something. And if something was felt, they would then send divers in who would try and find whatever there was to see. But nothing turned up. The only thing that turned up that was found a couple of weeks into the search was a camouflage hat. And Brian Winchester eventually identified that hat, saying that Mike had purchased that hat the prior month when the two of them were hunting together in Arkansas. In fact, he brought a picture to the FWC tent and showed the FWC officers a picture of Mike wearing what appeared to be that very same hat. But there was nothing that ever turned up that was torn or suggested alligator presence or that an alligator had gotten to Mike. However, 6 months after Mike went missing.
Wow. Now, wait a minute. We're now jettisoned up to 6 months after this,
yes,
this missing. Now, have they proclaimed him dead by this point? How has the family been? So you tell us what you were about to tell us about 6 months afterwards, but then I'd like to know what's been happening with the family and the lives that have been affected by this tragedy.
Well, I'll backtrack and say that when the official investigation concluded in early February, there was a memorial service that Denise's family insisted on holding for Mike, that they had to move on with their lives. It was against the wishes of Cheryl Williams. By the way, Mike's dad, I didn't mention it, had died about a year before all this happened, so he wasn't around anymore. But they had this memorial service. Cheryl participated in it, kind of against her will, and Denise sort of started going on with her life, and the rest of her family started going on with their lives from that point forward. However, it became clear that she was not going to be able to collect on the life insurance, and that's where the life insurance comes into play. And it was fairly significant as this investigation got into a much higher gear in later years. It turns out that a few months before Mike disappeared, he procured a $1 million insurance policy from none other than Brian Winchester. Brian was a life insurance agent. He worked at his dad's agency, Winchester Financial Group, and he both did financial planning and sold insurance. And he sold Mike a $1 million policy. It was in April, I think, of 2000. And Denise tried to collect not only on that policy, but on a couple of other policies that Mike had to the tune of $1.75 million. But she couldn't, she learned, because Mike hadn't been declared dead. And what she learned from an attorney was there was a process through which they could seek a presumptive death certificate. And she started meeting with that attorney somewhere around March of 2001. And he was in the process of putting together what was needed for court when, lo and behold, in June, a mysterious development occurred. A fisherman.
Let me back up real quickly, though. This, just so sure. We're painting the right picture, most people start trying to look into life insurance shortly after a death, and that it took till March for her to start to get to the next level of getting that death certificate. Right. I mean, it's not like any of this is red flagging, right? I mean, he's the one that purchased the insurance. She knows about it. Why wouldn't she try to claim on it?
But as it turned out, as folks will learn in reading the book, a fact that wasn't discovered until fairly late in the game was that her application, her claim for life insurance proceeds to this company, Kansas City Life Insurance, was actually filled out just a couple weeks after Mike disappeared, while the investigation was still ongoing. I think it was January the 9th. So while the investigation was still ongoing, Denise files the claim for life insurance when people are still actively searching for her husband. So that is a little bit fishy that she was trying to claim his life insurance so quickly. And that's how they learned that Kansas City Life Insurance wasn't going to pay, which is how the lawyer got involved to file a petition for a presumptive death certificate. Ordinarily in Florida, you can't have a person declared dead with that petition for 5 years after they have gone away and aren't found. So this was to accelerate that process by some 4.5 years and have him declared dead, just as it turned out, 6 months after he went missing. And you have to show that it's virtually certain that he's dead. And so one of the ways they were able to show that it was virtually certain that he was dead was by some discoveries that were made in Lake Seminole at Stump Field in June of 2001. A fisherman was doing his fishing early one morning and saw something out of the corner of his eye, and he motored over to it. It turned out it was a pair of hunting waders. That fisherman was from Sneeds, and he knew about all of the work that had been done to try to find Mike Williams, and so he got the FWC, the Florida Wildlife Commission, involved because they wanted to know, were these Mike's waders? And if they were, was there any sign of, you know, alligator teeth? Was there any sign of human remains in them? And so they actually pulled them out carefully and sifted the water through and checked for any sign of human remains, and there were none whatsoever. But this was, you know, a potentially promising lead that all of a sudden these waders had been found. But they were extremely suspicious because the very spot where they were found had been searched intensively for weeks. The whole area was covered with people searching, and nothing like that was found. So it was suspicious. A couple of days later, a couple of people go out onto a boat in the exact spot where the waders were found and send a diver down to see if anything else is down there. Lo and behold, that diver comes up with a hunting jacket, and inside that hunting jacket is a hunting license. And the hunting license was issued by the state of Arkansas to Mike Williams. And also found right in that same spot was a flashlight that was confirmed to be a flashlight that Mike's mom had given him a few weeks before he took this trip to Lake Seminole. So now you have all these pieces falling into place. Denise appears with her lawyer before a judge, and a presumptive death certificate is issued, and she's able to collect on $1.75 million in life insurance.
Now, are the bells ringing at this point that how did we find waders and a jacket and all this information, but there's no marring of it, like it's been torn apart? There's no remains. There's no blood. I mean, I understand it's been underwater, but I would think there would be some biological DNA had this been an attack by an animal. Or more importantly, do clothes just fall off of bodies underwater after a certain period of time?
Well, the problem is that there was never a criminal investigation, so nobody was asking the questions that you're asking. Instead, it was viewed as a boating accident from day one, and the Florida Wildlife Commission filled out a boating accident form that basically closed their investigation. And no criminal agency, no criminal law enforcement agency picked up the baton from there. So all kinds of things that were potentially evidence were no longer going to be available by the time somebody said this needs to be investigated as a potential crime. That now, didn't happen until 2004.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, as somebody who practices law, you know this guy's history, you know his life, you know what he's like, and, you know, the tragedy that it seems, this boating accident, would it have been something that, you know, without your ability to see through this now, having written the book, is it something you would have gone after as a criminal charge at any point? Or would that have, like, you know, I guess what I'm wondering is that normal for them to just automatically assume it was a boating accident, knowing his past? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's no history that Mike had ever had a similar accident like this where he had gotten hurt or anything bad had happened. There was an incident that Brian Winchester would tell others about where Mike did, in a similar situation, fall overboard, and that Brian was the one to pull him back into the boat. So, you know, hunters do have mishaps for sure. And that's one of the reasons Mike procured this very large insurance policy, is because his boss, Clay Ketchum, said, Mike, you're taking more and more risks these days. You want to protect your family, so you should have more insurance. So this type of incident happening is not that surprising. This type of incident happening something bad happening and never being found, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
All right. Well, now we've recovered all of these things. What happens? You said that this is enough for them to go ahead and pay out. But where do the red flags start to pop up? When does somebody start to say this, something's not adding up here?
There was nobody who was saying those things except for Cheryl Williams. She would not give up. She did not believe that her son had died. In fact, or died in an accident, at least. In fact, Cheryl went to the lake for the very first time, I believe it was Christmas Eve, the day before Christmas. Nick took her there, and she stood at the edge of the lake, and she heard God telling her, Cheryl, Mike is not here at Lake Seminole. He did not fall overboard and drown. He was not eaten by alligators. You need to go find Mike and bring him home.
Wait a minute.
She will tell you that to this day. She heard God tell her that standing on the shores of Lake Seminole.
She hears the word of God. Now, I'm assuming, have talked with this woman. Do
yes.
you believe that this, she was truly receiving some kind of divine message, or do you think this was mother's intuition that something was off? I'm just curious where you land on that.
I land on Cheryl firmly believes that she heard the voice of God, and whether it was her intuition or some divine intervention doesn't really matter, because that woman from that day forward was on a one-woman crusade to find Mike and bring him home. And had it not been for that, this would have been chalked up as a boating accident and a unfortunate hunter who was in the wrong place at the wrong time with a bunch of alligators, and that's how his demise was met. Had it not been for Cheryl and her persistence and perseverance through two decades.
My God, what a tragedy to lose somebody that you care so deeply about, but to know in your heart of hearts that something is wrong. How is his widow living her life at this point? Obviously, there's quite a big span between his death and the resolution of this case. What can you tell us about her life?
Well, she went on with life. She got her money. She started buying property. She made a lot of investments in stocks with the help of Brian's father, Marcus Winchester. She was doing very well. She continued working. She had a couple of different jobs, ultimately working as an accountant. She was an accountant. I hadn't mentioned that. She also graduated from Florida State. And she was working eventually at Florida State in their controller's office. But she was doing very well. Nice cars, nice life, raising Ansley. And there's one other thing that happened. She started having a relationship with Brian Winchester. And by 2004, gone up.
So how soon after her husband disappears does she begin this relationship?
According to whom?
Well, let's hear the different timelines from what you do know and you were able to uncover.
Well, I will tell you that both Denise and Brian were asked that very question by law enforcement officers when the investigation finally began in 2004, and they gave different answers about when the relationship began and whether it was even still existing, which should have been serious red flags. But they both said that the relationship started after Mike died, although Denise said that it started just a few months after Mike died. Brian said it started a few years after Mike died or went missing. But Denise was basically telling law enforcement officers who were questioning her in December of 2004 that within a few months of Mike disappearing from Lake Seminole, she and Brian were in a relationship together. Now, as it turns out, that's not necessarily the correct timeline either. But it starts raising questions about, okay, you look at the insurance, you look at Brian having been the one to have found Mike's boat out at Lake Seminole, you look at Brian having been the one to identify the hat at Lake Seminole, and you start putting all of these things together, and now, in December of 2005, that relationship blossoms to the point that they get married. And Brian moves into the home that used to be Mike's home, starts sleeping in the bed next to Denise where Mike used to sleep. And now Brian and Denise are a couple and raising Ansley and raising Brian's child, Stafford, no different than the life Denise was living with Mike.
Now playing
and that turned a lot of heads.
Now playing the devil's advocate, though. Here you've got a mourning widow. She comes into a great amount of money. She is friends with this gentleman who starts helping her in investing and walking her through it. I'm sure they're spending a lot of time. From the outside, that doesn't sound so nefarious to me. Maybe, and you know, people in grieving times are emotionally, you know, wrought, and they are looking for a connection to feel whole and human again. So in this kind of connection, that doesn't sound overall, I mean, again, you have the gift of being able to have sifted through all this, but I mean, you know people, you know life and death and how it interacts. Would any of these signals really kind of, other than, well, that's kind of icky that she got together with somebody so quickly again and moved on, which everybody seems to judge differing on, you know, what timelines they feel comfortable this kind of thing should take place. But really, was that suspicious at the point?
In and of itself, probably not. But you add all of these various things together. And then the one thing that unfortunately investigators didn't pick up on in real time, and for that matter, wasn't even a focus of the trial. But that is that Denise and Mike both told Cheryl and Nick that that morning, December 16th, Mike was going hunting with Brian. And as it turned out, somehow at the last second, Brian's not part of that. And then as the investigation, yes, because Brian wasn't there, and Brian says, no, actually he made arrangements to go hunting with his father-in-law that morning. But he never made it there because he overslept. And so he had to call his father-in-law and say that same morning, sorry, I overslept, and I'm not going to make our hunting trip together. Well, that's where you have to start understanding Brian's relationship with his own wife, Kathy. Kathy was also a student at North Florida Christian School. In fact, Kathy was Mike's girlfriend between the two Denises. But ultimately, in the 11th grade, Brian and Kathy got together, and Brian and Kathy and Mike and Denise became a fearsome foursome. They did everything together in high school, in college, and as adults. Their babies were born just a few months apart. They were in each other's homes constantly. And so Kathy and Brian were married when all of these events transpired. And yet, by September 11th, 2001, Kathy is packing her bags and leaving. Her relationship with Brian has become unbearable. Kathy knows some things, but has a child that she's sharing with Brian named Stafford. He's very young, and she doesn't want to necessarily go tell law enforcement what she knows. Eventually, after Cheryl started the investigation, by that time, Kathy was remarried. Her new husband, Rocky, and she had had discussions about this topic enough that Rocky implored her to go talk to Cheryl and come clean with what she knew. And when she did that, what Cheryl learned was that Brian was not at home the morning of the murder, wasn't there at all. And in fact, they were supposed to go to a Christmas party together in Cairo, Georgia that afternoon, and Brian never showed at their home to make the trip together. He showed up hours later in Cairo, Georgia by himself. And Kathy had kept that close to the vest for years when, without a criminal investigation, nobody was asking those questions. And so now you have this contention by Brian that he told law enforcement when he was interviewed that he was supposed to go hunting with his father-in-law but overslept, that doesn't jive with what Kathy says was going on that morning. He wasn't there.
Hmm. And this takes how long before people really start pulling these strings and realizing that this story is beginning to unravel?
Well, it's 2004 when Denise and Brian meet with law enforcement for the first time, late 2004. And Kathy is meeting with them throughout 2004 into 2005 and eventually provides additional assistance because she and Brian see each other quite often because they're picking up Stafford from school. They're transitioning Stafford between their homes. So Kathy becomes a source of information for law enforcement, and it becomes clear from some of Brian's communications with Kathy that he's getting very concerned that he may be the subject of a criminal investigation. And he implores Kathy to tell investigators that he overslept that morning and he had been at home. And that's what really happened. And that also, they went to Cairo, Georgia together on the family Christmas trip. In other words, he was asking Kathy to lie for him. And Kathy reported this to law enforcement. So law enforcement knew that Brian had all kinds of things that he was talking with Kathy about that were completely inconsistent with what he had told them. And Kathy had information herself that was completely inconsistent with what Brian had told them. But the investigation eventually peters out. Why? Because Brian and Denise are married. They have a privilege that protects their communications between them. And because there's no hard physical evidence that was collected from Lake Seminole or anywhere else, because for years, no one treated this as a potential crime. So years go by and nothing happens to move things forward other than Cheryl Williams and a woman by the name of Jennifer Portman. So Cheryl, we know, is tenaciously fighting for justice and answers. But she doesn't just do that by trying to get a law enforcement investigation going and checking up with law enforcement. She takes matters into her own hands. Back in the early days of her life with raising children, Greyhound had a strike. And she became a picketer on the front lines on behalf of her husband, JJ. And she would carry these picket signs for hours every night of the week, trying to prevent people from actually boarding buses for Greyhound. That became part of her DNA. Well, after nothing was happening with this investigation, she started doing the same thing. She started picketing outside of the church that Brian and Denise went to, holding a sign that Mike had been missing since December 16, 2000. She would bring the same sign and picket outside of the gates of the Centennial Oaks subdivision where Brian and Denise were now living, raising Ansley. She made a nuisance of herself. She had posters placed all over town that Mike was missing, and if anybody knew anything, to please call law enforcement. She had billboards put up throughout town in very conspicuous places with Mike's picture on the billboards, with telephone numbers for the state attorney's office and for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And she started writing letters to the governor. Over 2,000 letters, one every single day.
Wow.
Now, somebody picked up on the tenacity of this woman, and her name was Jennifer Portman. She caught an ad in the local newspaper, the Tallahassee Democrat. Jennifer Portman had just moved to Tallahassee from the Midwest. She was a young, enterprising reporter. She had gone to the McGill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in Chicago. She was a sharp reporter. And she saw an ad Cheryl had paid $1,200 to put in the Tallahassee Democrat that read, "My son is missing," and had all kinds of information about what happened at Lake Seminole, and implored readers, if they knew anything, to please call law enforcement. And Jennifer Portman dug into that story, and this is in 2006, and she eventually produced three articles on the Mike story that were published on the anniversary of the sixth anniversary of his disappearance in December of 2006. And she would write dozens more stories from that point until justice was finally served. She became as much a part of this story as Cheryl Williams herself.
And
those stories, and all Cheryl did, put tremendous pressure on law enforcement to make something happen and figure out what happened and bring somebody to justice. But even all those things didn't work, until a very lucky break occurred in August of 2016.
So what is that final switch that gets flipped that opens this up finally?
Denise is coming out of her Centennial Oaks home on August 5th of 2016. It has been 4 years since she and Brian have lived together. Their marriage deteriorated very badly, and in 2012, they separated. Brian eventually winds up living in a palatial estate that Denise and he bought together, hoping they were going to move there on a place called Lake McBride. Brian eventually winds up living there, but he's living there alone. In fact, by August of 2016, even his son won't talk to him because his son had found his cell phone one day and was scrolling through some pictures and found pictures of Brian with prostitutes. And once he saw that, his son wanted nothing further to do with him, and Kathy, his wife, wanted nothing further to do with him. And to the extent he was trying to reconcile with Denise, Denise wanted nothing further to do with him. So his life was deteriorating very, very rapidly. And now we get to August 5th of 2016. Denise comes out of her home, gets into her car, and starts driving to work at Florida State, starts calling her sister as she does every morning, and out from the back seat jumps Brian Winchester with a gun, and he kidnaps her. And he is screaming at her, and he has her at gunpoint kidnapped for about an hour. Eventually, they both calm down, and Brian leaves her vehicle, and the plan was is that they were going to meet later that day with Brian's father, Marcus, and talk about all of the issues they had and why Brian had seen fit to kidnap her that morning. Well, That's not what happened. Denise eventually winds up going to law enforcement about the kidnapping incident. She goes to the Leon County Sheriff's Department, where she's interviewed not only about the kidnapping incident, but about whatever happened to Mike. And they're trying to put pressure on her to squeal on Brian. Interestingly, one of the officers who's putting pressure on her to squeal on Brian is her own brother-in-law, Dave McCraney, who's married to her sister, who she was on the phone with earlier that morning. In fact, her sister tracked her down. Her sister, Deborah, tracked her down before she made the decision of whether she was going to Florida State to work or going to report the incident to law enforcement. And while they're in the car together, Dave McCraney, the police officer on the phone with her, insisting that she report the incident to law enforcement, which she eventually does. And he eventually shows up in the interrogation room with Denise saying, "Brian killed Mike," or "Brian did something to Mike. That's what happened, isn't it? We know that's what happened." And Denise says, "No, that's not. I never would have married him if I thought he had anything to do with Mike disappearing." And then an FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement agent, comes into the room, and he interrogates her for about 25 minutes. And all of this is available on the website that I've put together, evilatlakeseminole.com, where you can watch Denise being interviewed by this law enforcement officer and giving absolutely incredulous, incredible responses to his questions about Mike and Lake Seminole. But she insists she knows nothing about what happened, and she doesn't believe Brian had anything to do with that. Well, they didn't get the information they wanted from Denise, but of course that leads to law enforcement going to pick up Brian because he's just committed a significant felony. And they bring him in, and he's interrogated, or they try to interrogate him in a room just a couple doors down from where Denise is. He refuses to speak. He lawyers up, and they start having proceedings in the kidnapping case. But they have under arrest, in jail, the person they believe can crack this case wide open. And ultimately, it did crack the case wide open.
That's pretty remarkable in itself, and that this guy would be such a loose cannon that he would do something so ridiculous as kidnap his ex-wife at gunpoint and not think that this might have some serious repercussions.
Unless he thought that she was about to squeal on him anyway, and he had nothing to lose.
Well, once this crack in the foundation begins to form, who flips on who first?
Well, they have Brian in custody. And not only is Brian facing a potential life sentence for kidnapping, Brian, having access to money because his family is wealthy, starts finding jail snitches and other people like that to work on fabricating evidence for him. So he eventually connects with an inmate named Wade Wilson and pays him a bunch of money to fabricate evidence against Denise so that the only witness against him would be tarnished. And when the state attorney's office learned of this, and they did, they were in the process of upping the charges against him. Meanwhile, his own lawyer was not getting the sort of treatment that he typically got for an armed kidnapping of someone who had never committed a crime before. He thought he could plead Brian out to 5 years, no problem, and yet he wasn't being offered anything less than life in prison. And the state attorney's office was telling him, that is, of course, unless he can assist us with something else. And, of course, that was what happened to Mike Williams. When these other obstruction of justice issues started coming to the forefront, where Brian was making things much, much worse for himself, that's the point at which his lawyer, Tim Jansen, went to the prosecutors and said, maybe we can work something out here. And that maybe we can work something out here led to what was called a proffer agreement between Brian and the state attorney's office, through which Brian would be questioned about everything he knew about Mike Williams. And based upon that information, he could not be prosecuted in any way, shape, or form. He could still be prosecuted and sentenced for kidnapping, but that information could not be used against him at all. And it was that information that led to the charges that were eventually brought, not against Brian, but against Denise.
Wow. All right. So Brian is, because of his plea deal, he's going to get off a lot easier on this, allegedly.
Well, the only deal on the sentencing is that the prosecutors could not ask for for life in prison. That was the only concession they made on the kidnapping. They asked for 45 years, and Brian was sentenced to 20 years in prison. He's currently serving that 20-year sentence. And so that day of the sentencing, where, by the way, Denise was the one who made the victim impact statement, and she implored Judge Hankinson, the judge, to sentence Brian to life in prison because she never wanted to fear him being on the streets again. You know, she was sitting at the prosecution table with the prosecutors, okay? And Brian is sitting at the defense table with his defense lawyers. The very next day, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement has a press conference to make a bombshell announcement. And their bombshell announcement is that human remains have been found. And based upon those human remains, they now know that Mike Williams was murdered the day after Brian Winchester was sentenced. And of course, it was the information that Brian provided to them that enabled them to develop the information to make that conclusion. That same day, just before that announcement is made, law enforcement shows up at Cheryl Williams' house and at Denise Williams' house. At Cheryl Williams' house, the state attorney himself is there, breaking the news that they have found Mike's remains and that he had been murdered. In fact, they took Cheryl out to the spot where Mike's remains were found. And I'm not going to spoil that for the readers, but it wasn't at Lake Seminole. And you have another set of investigators show up at Denise's doorstep also to share with her, right? She was the victim. She was the wife, to share with her that her former husband's remains had been found. And a very different reaction than Cheryl's reaction. She was almost nonplussed by the information that Mike's remains had been found. See, there was something else that had been going on with Denise. She had been part of a sting operation by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and someone had approached her just a few weeks before in the parking lot at Florida State on her way into work and scared her and then left her a note saying he wanted her to call her because he was a friend of Brian's and he wanted to talk with her. And she was so freaked out by that that she went and reported that incident through Florida State's campus police, and it eventually got escalated to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. It wasn't real. That the person who approached her was actually an undercover agent. And she was much more concerned as they're standing on her doorstep breaking this news about Mike's remains being found. She was much more concerned about whether they had found the guy who had approached her at the Florida State parking lot. And that's what she wanted to follow up with on, not Mike's remains having been found. Well, as it turns out, they continued working their case.
Right.
They had another confidential informant assisting them throughout the spring of 2018. And that confidential informant turned out to be Kathy Thomas, who was still very good friends with Denise. And she agreed with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement that their phone calls, her phone calls with Denise, would be recorded for potential use. And they actually scripted her out in one phone call as to what she was going to say. And she was going to tell Denise, and she did, that she had received a subpoena to come to the state attorney's office, and it had something to do with Mike. And she's on the phone for 20 minutes, crying, sobbing, spilling her guts about how she didn't want to do that because she's known all these years that something wasn't right with Denise, that Mike had suspected Denise was having an affair, and that Brian's story didn't make sense. And that phone call with Denise was probably the thing that tipped the scales sufficiently for them to get an indictment from the grand jury, which they did for first-degree murder. And on the very day that Ansley turned 19, they come to Florida State and camp out at the controller's office and walk into Denise's personal office and say, "Miss Williams, you're under arrest for the murder of Mike Williams."
What a long and coming service of justice, but what a horrific tragedy. Just for $1.7 million and a lover to end the life of a really good, decent man. Unbelievable. It's sad that that's the basics for most murders. Just greed and lust and in this case, a charismatic mixture of both. It's just horrifying to see this. Now, what their daughter Ansley, what has she done, and how did this impact and affect her?
Okay, well, that's a great segue that makes us rewind the tape all the way to August of 2001. See, Cheryl started writing the Tallahassee Democrat, trying to get them to publish stories about this right from the beginning. And by August of 2001, the Tallahassee Democrat did a very short piece on missing persons of local interest. And because of Cheryl's persistent letters, they agreed to include Mike in that story. And Mike had Cheryl had her son Nick bring a picture of Mike over to the newsroom, and it was published along with a little story about what had happened to Mike at Lake Seminole. Cheryl received a call that same day that story was published from Denise. And Denise was livid. She was seething. She said, I want you over at my house right now. And in the front yard, she wouldn't even let her go in. She wouldn't let her see Ansley. She said, I don't ever want to see Mike's name in the newspaper again. I don't ever want to see his picture in the newspaper again. If you persist in doing things like this, Cheryl, you will never see Ansley again. That was August of 2001. Now, she didn't make good on that threat then. Cheryl continued to have very restricted, but she did have access to Ansley for years thereafter. In fact, she had some overnights with Ansley when Denise was going out of town, as it turned out, sometimes when Denise was with Brian. But in January of 2005, the day before Cheryl's birthday, another phone call. Nick and Cheryl are out. I think it's a Saturday afternoon. They're having lunch, and Denise says that she wants to meet Cheryl at her home. What time will they be there? So at 2 o'clock that afternoon, Cheryl is anxiously awaiting Denise to arrive, she believes with Ansley, as an early birthday present. But the person who is at her side that morning isn't Ansley, that afternoon isn't Ansley. It's Brian. And they walk in, and it becomes clear that another confrontation is about to begin. Denise, Nick, and Cheryl sit down at the dining room table. Brian is by the front door. And Denise says something along the lines of, Miss Cheryl, you know we love you, but if you continue with this criminal investigation, we just can't have you seeing Ansley anymore. So you're going to need to drop this criminal investigation. And it was at that point that Nick said, well, my mom and I want to know what you and Brian did to Mike. And at that point, Brian and Denise stormed out of the house, and they made good on Denise's threat that day. From that day, January of 2005, until today, July 13th, 2020, Cheryl Williams has never seen her granddaughter, Ansley.
Oh. What a heartbreak. Is there any chance that Ansley isn't Mike's?
That's a great question. And the answer to that question is in the book. There hasn't been formal testing, so there's no definitive answer. But if you look at their photographs, particularly when they were children, what everybody seems to say is that child had such a resemblance to Mike, and not only Mike, to Mike's dad, JJ, that there's no way it is not Mike's child. And so Brian, under oath, has said the same thing, that that child is not his child. That is Mike's child.
So here's a question. Now, I know that in a case like this, if I had a large life insurance policy out on Tim and I murdered him and collected on it, and then they found out I murdered him, I'd be stripped of that money and all of that. But because his widow and the child got the money, would money restitution have to be paid back, or does it just roll over to the daughter? Because even though it was a murder by the mother, it was 20 years ago, and the money now just reverts to the daughter, who would have been the next in line had the mother been arrested at that time for the murder anyway.
So in a circuitous kind of way, that is exactly what happened. But here's how it happened. After Denise was charged with murder, another indictment was unsealed against her for insurance fraud. And that indictment was hanging out there all through the time that she was prosecuted for murder. We know how that turned out. It didn't turn out well for Denise. And instead of prosecuting her for insurance fraud, the state attorney's office agreed that she wouldn't be prosecuted at all for insurance fraud as long as she gave up all of the money that she had and her house to Ansley. And that house is now Ansley's house, the one that Mike was so eager to buy and to fill with children and to fill with love. That house is now Ansley's house because Denise had to give it up. All of Denise's money that was in stocks and bonds and other pieces of land, all of that has now been signed over to Ansley.
Well, that's good. At least she wasn't stripped of both parents and her life and everything. At least something good came out for Ansley. And I know that sounds horrific even saying it, but I'm just saying overall, I mean, you lose your dad, then find out years later it was your mom that murdered your dad, and then your lifestyle is upended okay. And you lose everything. That would be brutal.
So there is one flaw in what you just said, that Ansley believes her mom murdered her father. Ansley believes no such thing.
Oh. She believes
none of Denise's sister. None of Denise's sisters believe any such thing. They sat behind, not Ansley, but the sisters sat behind the defense counsel table throughout the trial, and were working together with the defense lawyers because they firmly believe in Denise's innocence, and that all of this, that there's no evidence that Denise had anything to do with any of this other than Brian telling a story to get even with Denise for having him arrested for kidnapping.
What do you really believe in all of this then? Do you believe that she did have a hand in this, or was she an unwitting participant in a bigger scheme?
Well, it comes back to the first day that Mike disappeared, when Denise started telling everyone that Mike had gone hunting alone. And that was never even part of the trial against her, but that is the most conspicuous fact probably in the entire case, because it is now 100% conclusively determined that Brian killed Mike. And he was with him at the time he died. He didn't go hunting alone. He went hunting with Brian, just as Cheryl and Nick were told that Thursday evening when they were watching Friends together. And yet Denise not only started telling everyone that day that Mike went hunting alone, in her petition for a presumptive death certificate, there was an affidavit in there saying that Mike had gone hunting alone. And not only that, that affidavit said that Mike had also told her the day before, that would be that Friday, that he was taking her to the Gibson Inn as a surprise for their wedding anniversary. In other words, that would be as if they had never told Cheryl and Nick that Thursday that that was their plan, that they were planning to go to the Gibson Inn for their anniversary. So there were things in Denise's affidavit that were clearly untrue. And that should have been a tip-off early on that there was a story being told that was not a factual story at all.
Could you tell us, where did they finally uncover his remains?
I'm going to leave that for the reader. It was not at Lake Seminole. I want to leave a few little tidbits for the readers.
That's fine. I respect that. Okay. Well, it's in the book. We've done a glossary look at the story, folks, and with all the great information that we got during this interview from Stephen, there's still so much more to learn and uncover. We have a link to that book on today's program, so make sure you click it, order the book, and make sure you rate and review the book so that it helps the authors and gets a higher presence in Amazon for these books to show up. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on to share the story with us. What a bizarre and heartbreaking story.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's been a pleasure. All right, let's kick you open the case files, Tim. We've got some dumb crimes and stupid criminals on tap next.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
911. What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Tim, just when I think things can't get worse, here I've been preparing this stay-at-home business for myself to create some finances.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out I might be doing something illegal, Tim.
Uh-oh. What are you doing illegal?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not sure. We got to read this article first to find out what I'm doing wrong. But listen, people, you know, Tim, we've reached this kind of classic legendary status as the hosts of the best in paranormal and true crime talk radio. And
right.
People are always wanting a piece of us. And I kind of had this idea only now to find out that somebody else is doing it and might be causing problems, Tim.
Like what?
A Tennessee man was cited by authorities for selling his own farts in containers without having a distributing permit. Authorities inquired as to whether he had authorization, and the man couldn't reply. He was offering farts from various types of food and with various ages. With around 150 containers, he was offering these farts as old as 1 week, said policeman Gary Cockburn. Each jug contained approximately 30% fart and 70% air, which he didn't clearly state in the sales materials. Additionally, the man didn't have the authorization to offer those farts, so we seized them, stated the authorities. He was offering nearly 90 jugs for each day, and many individuals are frantic in light of the fact that they now can't have their sweet, delightful farts available to them, Tim. So I guess maybe I can continue. I just have to get a distributing permit.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah?
How much do you charge for a fart?
Well, Tim, for my farts in a jar, depending on, of course, like if I've just eaten a delicious, delicious ribeye steak that cost me a lot of money with sauteed mushrooms and onions and those long asparagus, things.
Sure.
And, I'm gonna charge a little bit more for that, Tim. That's an expensive, delicious meal. And for something like that, I would, I'd give it the Darkness Dave $50 fart of approval.
Whoa!
Yeah.
$50 now,
Tim, if I just whipped up a couple of Nathan's Own hot dogs in home, boiled them up, threw them in a bun, and farted in a jar. Farted in a jar, Tim, that's like a $5 jar right there.
That's the old $5 fart offering.
I'd call them Phantom Farts, and that would be PHANTOM. PHARTS, Phantom Farts from Darkness Dave.
Very nice.
And I thought this is great. You know, people always want to have that part of you, something that they can have and take with them. Listen, I'm willing to let them take this with them wherever they go. They could just uncork it, give it a little huff like me with Play-Doh cans, Tim, what if I emptied Play-Doh cans that have that beautiful Play-Doh scent in them, farted into the Play-Doh can, put the lid on and sold those? That would be like a $75 premium Phantom Fart.
Not only
do you get the scent of the food, but you also get delicious, delicious Play-Doh scent.
You emptied a little of your colon into the Play-Doh can, then shoved the Play-Doh back in there so the Play-Doh would absorb your scent. And you'd have Dave's scented Play-Doh.
Yeah. I don't think I could call it Play-Doh. I'd have to call it
Dave Dough. Dave Dough, huh?
Phantom Fart Dough. How about that? Phantom Fart Dough.
That's a little much. I like Dave Dough. It's Play-Doh, but Dave scented.
Yeah. I like it. Let's, now maybe I'm back in business. I just have to figure out where I can get that distribution certificate that allows me to fart in a can and sell it.
Although
I mean, you'd buy one of those, right? How about, Tim, let me ask you this.
Although, can you imagine somebody's kids running in and going, Mommy, look, I made a dog. And then Mommy going, oh, but honey, why do your fingers smell like Nathan's hot dogs in ass?
But it would be good. It's a scented, it's tactile, it's invigorating and gets all of your senses involved in play, Tim. Your smell, your visual, your dexterity, your color cord. I think I'm actually doing them a favor.
Oh,
gotta look into this a little bit more. All right. A maskless man wields a gun after getting kicked out of an Arizona yogurt shop, Tim. We're going to Yuma, where a Yuma man was ejected after or from a frozen yogurt shop for not wearing a mask. He's facing charges for pulling out a gun in response, which seems a bit overkill.
Yeah.
Yuma County Sheriff's officials say the incident happened around 6:15 p.m. Thursday when 64-year-old Steve Covington entered Tiki Hut frozen yogurt. According to the staff, Covington was agitated when told to wear a face covering and gloves provided by the store. Covington then started dispensing frozen yogurt into his bare hands. A worker escorted him out of the shop. Authorities say that's when Covington got a handgun from his car and followed the employee. The store was locked down, but Covington allegedly pointed the gun at the employee and tried to get inside the store and a neighboring business. He then fled, but responding deputies found him. They seized the gun and arrested Covington without incident. He was booked into jail on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, misconduct involving weapons, and disorderly conduct. It's not known as of Friday if he has an attorney to comment on his behalf. And if he's looking for one, he can simply call my partner, Tim, at 612.
Dave.
What, Tim? I'm trying to give out our law number so that people can call in for Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, and Tim Dennis, our illustrious and prestigious law firm.
Right. Here's the deal. I prefer to take a lot of that stuff over email. Things have gotten really politically charged lately, especially with the whole mask thing. And I don't know why politically charged, because it really is it's a medical issue.
Right.
I mean,
but we're just trying to help people with crimes that need help that maybe other attorneys aren't willing to take on, Tim. And, you know, you could read emails, which could take, you've seen some of these emails we get. They could take 45 minutes to get to the point.
No,
whereas a quick phone call to 612.
But it's just easier for me to go through the email very quickly. Uh-huh. I can pretty much get to the point of an email very quickly. Some people just rant and you know, and mask this and my freedom this you know what? I can get right to the point of an email and, you know.
Did you just in my ear?
I did. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. But you know, it's really unnecessary. You know, this morning, Dave, for example, I'm reading a story about it. And this is not a political statement in the least, folks. It's a common sense thing. I'm reading a story about a guy who was like, I'm not going to wear a mask. I'm going to go out and drink at a bar and I'm not going to wear anything. And I'm going to this and I'm, you know, and I get my freedoms and blah, blah, blah. And guess what, folks? The guy just died of COVID. Now,
well, you know, karmic justice has a way of serving itself cold, Tim, with a cold brewski.
If you're going to go jump in a cold lake and think you're not going to die of hypothermia, well, you know what? Chances are you are. I'm just saying.
But it's my God-given American right to choose, Tim. Hot poo!
Then it's your God-given right to die, too.
Let's get off of this topic, because that's just going to cause more hell on the road down our path here. Oregon man, speaking of road, Tim, driving a stolen car crashes into a woman driving another stolen car. That right there, Tim, is a case of swift justice, if ever I've heard one. Swift justice! Police chase in Oregon ended when a driver fleeing authorities in a stolen car crashed into a woman driving yet another stolen car. The debacle took place Monday when police responded to a report of a stolen Toyota Land Cruiser driving through downtown Newburgh, according to the Newburgh-Dundee police. A pursuit ensued, lasted for several blocks until the driver crashed into another car near an intersection. Now, cops identified the driver of the first car as Randy Lee Cooper of Portland. After taking Cooper into custody, the police realized that the second car was also reported stolen in an unrelated crime 3 weeks ago. The driver of that car, Kristen Nicole Begu, was also found to be under the influence. Cooper was charged with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, attempting to elude police, assault, and reckless driving. Two cases of swift justice, Tim. Right there. Boom.
Bam.
Crashed into the law.
I'm sure that they didn't enjoy it, but yeah.
Looks like about 8 people sent me that story, so I'm just getting past those.
Okay, yeah.
All right, here we go, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
A Nanamio man dressed in saran wrap and underwear spotted at Woodgrove Mall. Physical distancing, washing hands, wearing masks, and covering yourself in saran wrap? Well, cabin fever has found a new life. During the COVID-19 pandemic, a man in Woodgrove Shopping Center in Nanaimo is its latest icon. A man covered in saran wrap, sporting a red pair of underwear over his head as a face mask, was confronted by mall security as he walked the halls earlier this week. Photos of the man that surfaced online Monday show him also sporting black hiking boots and a leotard because, well, why not, Tim?
No,
all the pretty ladies. All the pretty ladies.
I got some reasons why not, but yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So it's all the single ladies. Eh?
Yeah.
I'm not as up on my Beyonce as I should be.
Yeah.
Witnesses on social media say the man dubbed himself the COVID Avenger, apparently as a form of protest against wearing masks. While health professionals have encouraged the wearing of masks in public to prevent the spread of the disease, no authorities have put out statements regarding saran wrapping yourself in a leotard with boots and a red pair of thong underwear over your face. I did. I guess the law enforcement didn't think they'd have to write something up for that kind of law, but it turns out we might need to.
Yeah, because, you know, again,
yeah,
common sense.
A Holmes Beach man's DUI arrest is now his sixth, but Tim, not to be stopped, it's his first one on a lawnmower. Holmes Beach, Florida, doesn't matter what you're driving, you can't drive drunk. Scott Pritchard learned that the hard way on July 4th when Holmes Beach found him allegedly driving drunk on his lawnmower. Police say he darted out in front of their cruisers with no lights on his vehicle. My officers were leaving one call, and all of a sudden across their path goes a grasshopper lawnmower, midnight, no lights. Holmes Beach Police Department Chief William Tokajer said, gentlemen went through the parking lot of a Cross Point Church all over the road. Officer said Pritchard has had a Mike's Hard Lemonade in his possession. Not a Mark's Hard Lemonade, Tim.
That's a different thing. Yeah.
Pritchard told officers he was retrieving his lawnmower from a neighbor's house. He figured that would be the only option for driving, but he is on the road. He is driving a vehicle while intoxicated. This is a rather large lawnmower. It is dangerous, Tokajer said. Police say this was Pritchard's sixth, not fifth, Tim, not fourth, not third, not his second or his first. This is his sixth DUI, but his first one while riding a lawnmower. Pritchard has past arrests for DUI in Florida, Michigan, and Illinois, Tim.
Oh, he's done the trifecta.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Tokajer said Pritchard's license was revoked in 86 and then permanently taken in 1992.
That's a long time ago.
This guy's on the road 30 years later after having his license revoked and six DUIs. Why is this guy not in prison for life? Oh, Dave, that's ridiculous. You don't put a man in prison for life. Yeah, you do, because he's got a problem. He doesn't even have a license.
Yeah, he's got issues.
Unbelievable.
They ought to just chain him to the radiator and feed him and put a little stool next to him, let him go to the bathroom, and then that's it. He can stay out of jail as long as you chain him to the radiator.
Well, this next story explains why Tim and I never arm wrestle anymore.
Well,
a drunken father,
because you broke my arm six times?
Well, there's that.
Yeah.
But none of them on a lawnmower, by the way.
Oh, yeah, true.
A drunken father's humiliating arm wrestling loss to his son in Kentucky sparked a shooting and then an eight-hour standoff with deputies, sheriff's officials said. Curtis Zimmerman, 55, was drunk when he challenged his juvenile son to an arm wrestling contest early Monday at home. According to Boone County Sheriff's Office, Zimmerman became agitated after losing to his son several times, prompting a spat between the pair that turned physical. Zimmerman proceeded to grab a gun as his son was going upstairs firing two shots inside his home.
What?
That's a sore loser.
Yeah, it is.
Zimmerman, who told deputies he fired his gun into the ceiling, refused to comply with deputies' commands when they responded to the home, resulting in an eight-hour standoff.
Jeez.
The Boone County Sheriff's Office hostage negotiation team spoke with Zimmerman throughout the morning and ultimately negotiated his safe surrender. sheriff's officials said, adding that two of Zimmerman's relatives earlier got out of the home unharmed. Authorities did not provide the age and identity of Zimmerman's son. Zimmerman, who was taken to a hospital to be evaluated, will face charges of first-degree wanton endangerment once he's released and will be taken to the Boone County Detention Center. Zimmerman was not listed in custody as of early Tuesday. Huh.
He's the teenager coming out of his room looking like a WWE superstar. Yeah, the one on roids. You know what? Take the L. If the teenager comes down and whoops you in an arm wrestling contest, take the L. Don't take
the loss. Yeah, for those of you that think Tim's telling you to take the elevated train,
no,
that's not.
No.
He's saying just take the loss. Yeah, move on. Loss. It's good. At some point, your children should be better than you.
Yeah, yeah. You're going to age. Yeah. At that point, don't take out a gun. Take out a switch. I mean, it's just easier to beat them that way and then go into custody. It's less time.
Another reason why I don't run, Tim, takes us to St. Petersburg, Florida. Police have shut down a road in St. Petersburg after a human head was found on the side of the road. Ah. A female jogger was out for a morning run when she spotted the gruesome discovery around 7 a.m. Police said she reported it to the agency. The decomposed remains were found near the intersection of 38th Avenue South and 31st Street South. Police said they didn't believe the person died at the scene, but they say the remains likely ended up on the side of the road within the past 2 days. They said the remains were badly decomposed, making it difficult to determine the person's race or gender.
Oh, my God.
It scares me as a mom, a single mom, said Kara Knepin, who also lives nearby. Detectives have closed 38th Avenue South for the investigation and are asking drivers to avoid the area. The area is near an overpass with woods on either side of the highway. I wonder if this is like a gator. Like chomping on somebody and goes walking across the road and pukes it up on the side of the road or drops the head as he's crossing the street.
Maybe. Or maybe somebody fell behind on a debt and got fed to a gator.
Yikes.
And, yeah.
Well, this is the time for our listeners to step the F up. According to an eyewitness, she did not jog in that same area the day before, said Yolanda Fernandez, a spokesperson for the St. Petersburg Police Department, but she did Sunday. And it was not here on Sunday. So we're asking anyone from the public who may have seen it or know something about the head at that intersection, please call the police, 727-893-7780. Only call with serious information, folks. Don't call and dick around. 727-893-7780. If you know anything about that horrific sight and murder and what happened or who that person might be. God, imagine so badly decomposed that they can't tell the race or sexual nature of the person.
Would you ever run again after that? I don't think I could. I could ever run outside after that again. I'd have to go to a gym.
I don't know. I think just running in general just sounds like a bad idea.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've never been a
Nothing
runner.
Nothing good comes from it.
No, I mean shin splints and
severed heads.
Breakdowns
of
knees.
Just to point out, too.
Yeah, well, there's that, too. Yeah, I mean, you know, dead bodies and stuff. But, you know, eventually you'll find a victim on the side of the road and you're done. But you know, I think at that point I'm done running outside. I think I get a treadmill and I take it inside and never to
and
return
hang your
outside.
Clothes on it?
Yes. And
like most people do?
Exactly, yeah. And I have a nice dryer rack after that.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Tim, as we wrap up today's Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals, an upstate New York man is fighting the fight of his life to keep a giant wooden penis sculpture on his front lawn.
Oh, of course. I mean, everybody should have one. I mean, it's that time of year.
Really?
We're all sprucing up our gardens. We're getting them nice and prepped. And I mean, you got a little gnome in the garden. You got a little, maybe a little statue. And of course, your giant wooden penis you put out there.
That's a mental note. Don't visit Tim's house for fear of giant penis
Dave,
sculptures.
Dave, I got you an early birthday gift. I've been meaning to bring it over.
Yeah, no.
I want to spruce up your garden, Dave. Return it. Dave, it's huge. It's huge.
Thank you.
In fact,
no,
I rented a U-Haul trailer to bring it over.
You know what? Drop it off at an orphanage or something.
No, Dave, the wife is going to enjoy it. I mean, it sits right in
Trust
the garden.
Me, she's perfectly fine with the size wood she has at home. Claiming a violation of his First Amendment rights to free speech, a woodworker is fighting to return a 7-foot pine penis sculpture to his front lawn. Jamie Gagne, who said he has a right to display what Gagne.
Oh, Gagne.
Not Gagne. Yeah. Jamie okay. Gagne, who said he has a right to display whatever he likes on his property, erected the sculpture after the town revoked his building permit for his workshop last October. Gagne said he tried to contact the code enforcer to discuss the situation and came up with an agreement. But after months of trying to reach him and getting no response, he decided on another tactic to get the town's attention: the installation of a penis carved out of wood in front of his Ruggles Road home. "It's an artistic expression of my frustration of not being able to finish my workshop," said Gagne, who also blogs as Wilton Woody. Of course he does. "I wanted to inject some levity into the situation, but the town didn't find it funny." Supervisor John Lant said the town received many complaints, and Gagne was arrested by New York State Police on June 18th, charged with displaying offensive sexual material. That day, the wood phallus was taken down. It's now prostrate on his side yard. Only the testicles remain, which was the name of your third album, wasn't it?
It was.
Led Zeppelin cover band, Only the Testicles Remain?
Yeah, yeah. And it was not one of the big sellers. I think people got a mental
Hard
image.
Yeah. Gagne says, "as a memorial with a sign placed just behind them reading, 'Castrated by State Police.'"
Wah, wah.
Now, with the help of a Queensbury lawyer, William White, the 32-year-old is fighting to have the charges dropped and his penis restored. It's absolutely my First Amendment right," Gagne said. "My lawyer said that the charges don't really apply to my case, and he will get them dismissed." When he first raised the statue, Gagne said most people thought it was hilarious. Many stopped and took photos straddling the sculpture. He also sent around a survey on Nextdoor of 72 respondents. He said 28% found it offensive. Others have stopped by to support Gagne. People in the neighborhood rallied around it, Tim. You think they're just stroking this guy's ego?
Oh, that may be.
But when Gagne's neighbor John Parker saw it on June 8th, he emailed town code enforcement officer Mark Mikens, writing that Gagne had put an awful lot of time and effort into being a jerk. Mikens wrote back, sympathizing with Parker, saying Gagne is doing everything to aggravate his neighbors, but he agreed with Gagne's lawyer, writing, "we cannot do anything about the erection in Mr. Gagne's yard, as it is his constitutional right to express himself." Parker, when reached on Monday, said he didn't complain about the penis and that his lawyer told him to not comment further. Gagne's problems with the town did not end with this arrest. On the Monday after his arrest, he received 7 citations from the town. They included violations of the noise ordinance, not having a certificate of occupancy for his workshop, and having items in the town's right of way, including a sign asking drivers to slow down for Shiloh, a reference to his dog that got hit on the road. "A lot of this seems to be triggered by my neighbor," Gagne said, "but the town is not giving me any options." Mikens said that the revocation of the building permit last October was because Gagne provided misleading documentation when he applied for that permit. So it's just a long, twisted tale, Tim, that ends in a giant wood penis being removed from a yard. But don't worry, the balls still remain.
Well, you know, Dave, I think we all need to gather together and stroke the ego of Wilton Woody. Because if anyone did need an ego stroke,
I'm afraid of slivers.
Yeah. We can wear gloves.
Our final story, Tim, I had to go out with this one. Few details have been released regarding the arrest of a man who stood naked in the middle of a Pembroke Pines intersection over the weekend. Multiple videos have been shared on social media of the man around 5 p.m. Saturday at the intersection of Forest Road and Pembroke Street West, the Upper Ottawa Valley OPP. Yeah, you know me. I said OPP, Tim.
Yeah, you know me.
Yeah, it says no charges have been laid at this point. Naked guy. No charges have been laid.
I get it.
And the individual was taken into custody under the Mental Health Act. His name or any other information has not been released. I said Pembroke Pines, Tim. You automatically thought Florida. Turns out it's in Canada.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
Canadian naked man makes his debut on today's show. Tim, one more? All right, fine. But this is it,
okay.
Tim.
All right.
No more after this.
Okay.
We're going to talk about the shocking moment a woman dressed as Minnie Mouse attacked a security guard on the Las Vegas Strip before Mickey and Goofy tried to pull her away.
Oh, come on, Minnie. Chill out.
Woman dressed as Minnie Mouse has been filmed violently assaulting a Las Vegas security guard. Shocking video was posted, Tim, of said attack on Instagram and shows a woman dressed up as a beloved Disney character getting into a brawl within seconds of the pair interacting with one another on the Sin City sidewalk. Minnie Mouse is seen to lose her head of the costume as she punches a redheaded woman who is seen to be wearing a black security jacket. And Goofy, believe it or not, is just standing there holding his head going, oh, oh, oh gosh. And Minnie Mouse is walloping the hell out of the security agent. Holy God. Both of Minnie Mouse's helmet came off her head, whatever you want to call it, and just unleashes. Meanwhile, Mickey has got his hands over his eyes and Goofy's just holding his buck teeth. Yeah. It's hilarious.
Was there any action taken at Caesars on this deal? Or
I don't know. No? During the punch-up, Minnie accidentally punches a man in a Mickey costume who is attempting to pull the women apart. A third member of the group, dressed as Goofy, simply watches while the fracas is in a full swing. The speed at which Minnie's fists come flying out completely caught the security guard lady off guard, and she quickly ended up on the floor with Minnie towering above her.
Yeah.
Eat that, bitch.
Intimidation tactics by many.
Yeah. Good God. Eventually, Minnie is pulled off. The woman, who by this time is lying on the ground, she picked up her yellow cartoon-style shoes and shouts, I ain't no bitch, bitch.
Yeah.
Surprised onlookers managed to take video of the melee with their cell phones. It's not known what fight was in relation to. However, the Daily News reports that the two women had been shouting at one another for some time before the punches flew. I have it on good authority that the security guard was hitting on Mickey.
Oh, that could be, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, who doesn't want a little bit of the Mouse House? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that. It was shortly after that Dana White called a press conference over at the Luxor and signed Minnie to a 3-fight deal at UFC, so...
Oh, boy, wouldn't that be awesome to see?
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this week, kids. We'll be back next week. Mark Anthony returns. More killer cuts, strange stories, and dumb crime, stupid criminals right here on the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is True Crime Tuesday.